think that all of us have these very deep feelings of tenderness.
You get stronger as you become more open.
If I can be vulnerable, that'll help other people be vulnerable.
And it doesn't work for me to be silent.
I can't believe I'm going to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell you this story.
This is the first time that I've told aloud.
If I could have known that you and I were alike, I would have had so much more hope.
Listening to other people's stories, you realize,
wow, these people are all experiencing the same thing that we are.
You are not the only one.
I'm Dr. Anne Hallward, and this is Safe Space Radio, the show about the subjects we would struggle with less if we could talk about them more.
My guest tonight is Patrice Lockhart, and we're going to be talking about the psychiatric treatment of eating disorders. Tonight is the first in an ongoing series on food and body image. Patrice Lockhart is a psychiatrist right here in Portland, Maine. She's the medical director of the New England Eating Disorders Program at Mercy Hospital. She also has a private practice in Gorham, and I recently learned she was a professional harpist before that. Welcome to Safe Space.
Thank you.
I'd like to start out by asking you how you got involved in the treatment of eating disorders. What was it that drew you to it?
My textbook was one particular patient that I worked with for 4 years during my residency training, who had several facets of eating disorder behaviors and had spent some time in treatment at the program that I am now in charge of. So I was curious about her treatment there. And I learned so much from her and just was fascinated with the aspect of life that is, I thought eating disorder treatment would be fairly limiting or narrow, and found it to be every bit of life. So when the position opened up, they actually came and looked for me, and I was looking at them very positively. It was a wonderful team to work with, and turned out to be a great fit.
That's so great. So when you say she was your textbook and that you learned so much from her, what did she teach you about eating disorders? And
this patient taught me to listen and to be flexible and to mostly be consistent with her. That she and others needed to count on the same things time and again. Whether they were able to be consistent themselves was another matter, but to have a level of trust that things were really going to be present when they needed them was the primary focus.
And just to flesh that out so I really understand you, being consistent, like, you know, by showing up on time, do you mean?
For starters, I guess showing up on time, although that's not my strong suit necessarily.
Okay.
I tend to get involved in things and spend, time finishing up and then not always starting things on time. I think just what to expect as a person in terms of relationships and having actions and words match so that this patient knew what to count on from me and trusted that I was willing to work with her family members, her other treatment providers, in providing a consistent message and a consistent background for her to be safe.
Uh-huh. So she trusted you.
Yes, ultimately, and actually then began to trust herself and her own instincts. So it was a really wonderful journey and has continued to be that way with many, many other patients.
Sounds wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to switch now to a little bit just talking about eating disorders themselves. I think it's almost impossible to grow up as a woman in our culture and not have some kind of degree of self-consciousness mm-hmm. about body. And I'm curious, how would you define when, you know, so there's a spectrum, in other words, of difficulty around bodies and food. How would you define when something becomes a real eating disorder? You know, if I was a family member who loved someone and I was worried, what are the markers that tell you this has really become something, you know, that's serious, that needs care, that needs treatment?
Well, there are very specific criteria in that fancy book that we have called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Manual of, illnesses as they're characterized. But I think I look at eating disorders and disordered eating as whenever it's affecting parts of your life in ways that don't work anymore. So I think it can be very objective in terms of diagnosing, but it also needs to be subjective in terms of how it affects a person's life. It may affect a marriage. It may affect schoolwork. It may affect how, you know, involved a child is with a family, or whether they're doing things that they enjoy anymore, or they are really so focused on their relationship with either food or exercise even, or laxatives and diuretics. And I think I trust a family member more than anybody. I think if a mother or a father comes to me and says, I'm worried, that's the biggest red flag you can have as a treater or as a teacher or a counselor or anyone that's, you know, a coach. If you got somebody saying, I'm worried, that's probably a pretty good instinct from someone who knows this person pretty well.
Trust your worry.
Yep. Trust your worry. I've had more patients say, oh, I wish I'd brought my kid in sooner, because they thought, oh, I don't want to rock the boat with my worry. But usually those instincts are well-founded.
So just to follow this analogy a little further, or this example, so say this person's worried and there's maybe a family member, let's say a teenage girl for the sake of it. You know, I can imagine that part of the hesitation to bring it up with them is not wanting to shame them or pathologize them. And I'm curious how you know, like in the treatment of something like alcohol problems, there's such a focus in AA anyway on getting people to admit they're an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. With an eating disorder, how important is it to have the person themselves admit that they have a real problem? Is that part of the focus of initial treatment?
I think it's really important because it's the first step in separating the person from the illness. Eating disorders become so insidious and become very close to a person. And also in their secrecy, it's kind of like hiding a bad boyfriend. You know, it may give you some gains that you really don't want to let go of, as you know that it's really bad for you. So keeping that quiet allows it to become much more ingrained in a part of a person. Identifying it as a set of symptoms that are separate from the core of the human, a lot of times I like to reintroduce relationships with people to take the place of the relationship with the eating disorder. And that requires communication and honesty and directness and even acknowledging a situation where you're really having a hard time. You can't do anything about something you don't identify.
Right. And when you say, you know, the things that might make it hard for a person to identify they have a problem, you said something like hiding a bad boyfriend because, you know, he still gives you, you get something good out of it, even though it's mm-hmm. hurting you. Do you think that's part of the reason why it's hard to acknowledge a problem, is because you're afraid of losing what the seeming benefits are?
I do. And I think it's complicated. It's not a straightforward path, as all relationships are complicated. So it requires a multi dimensional approach for really readiness to look at something that's harmful to you. Allowing others to help is a really big piece. Self-examination and self-honesty. You know, humans, we were born with this gift of self-deceit. Sometimes we just want something to be true so badly that we will believe it. And that protects us from other dangerous things. But really, learning how to be honest in terms of safety is learning how to tolerate distress as well. So it's a really important set of skills to learn, and I think it's a developmental set of skills. You know, food is just fuel as well as fun and joy and, you know, pleasurable conversation and joining folks around a table and experiencing sensory wonderfulness. When it gets taken out of that realm and made into a bad thing, that's a really it's an alarming process. And when a person becomes his or her own worst enemy, really they need a lot of help to get out of that. It's not something that can really be conquered alone very often.
So when we talk about it as a dangerous process, I wonder if we could just spend a little time talking about the actual medical consequences. Mm-hmm. And I guess first let's focus on anorexia. So the person becomes mm-hmm. dangerously thin. Mm-hmm. What is the actual danger there? What are the medical consequences of that?
Boy, malnutrition affects every organ system. The big ones that we focus on that are the hardest hit would be the heart and the bones and the brain.
Okay.
So if you look at a person who's 20% below their healthy body weight, their brain is also missing 20% of its capacity. So we see, you know, you may have someone who does great in school, who's getting all A's or about to finish a master's degree, but they can't problem solve very well. They can't focus on more than one thing at a time, and their thinking becomes very rigid. Pure malnutrition doesn't even have to be an eating disorder diagnosis for malnutrition to have that much of an impact. It also is muscle wasting when weight is low. The heart is the strong arm muscle of the body and the most important pump. So if you have muscle wasting in your legs and arms, you're going to have it in your heart as well. Bones also, especially teenage bones and young women's bones who don't have enough body mass or enough body composition in the appropriate ratios, bones won't grow. And you can't replace that in any form except with nutrition. There have been all sorts of studies now that are finally showing the results of oral estrogen replacement doesn't protect bones. It may produce menstrual periods, but it won't protect the bone growth. So I really look at teenagers as such a huge area of focus. I don't want them to be in their disordered patterns for any, you know, a minute longer than they have to be, because they're not going to get that bone growth back, and it will really cripple them for life.
And I understand when you talk about muscle wasting in the heart, I understand also you can have dangerous heart rhythms.
Yes, the heart, when the muscle's not pumping appropriately, there are also enzymes. This would, if you want to differentiate for a patient who is bulimic, purging by vomiting or using other substances, electrolytes get distorted when those electrolytes are lost in the vomiting, and it's also in terms of the substances used. So the cardiac function, it's like short-circuiting your circuit board here in the radio station. Something may just stop at the wrong time and could cause, you know, all sorts of dangerous things, including a heart attack and death.
So here you are, you're working with these illnesses that can, in fact, have very significant life-altering consequences for mm-hmm. someone. What are the biggest challenges for you in your work?
I think for me personally, it's allowing people who are in danger to continue to make decisions for themselves. It's my favorite part of the work and the most challenging, in that I have utmost respect for every single patient, and I have no respect for these illnesses. So when a patient comes in practically glued to an illness, it really takes some finesse and timing to knock the illness out of the way without hurting the patient. So I am constantly thinking about my own level of worry, my own level of patience, how to connect with a person not through their illness, so that I get to establish a relationship with the human and not with the dangerous side. So I'm thinking about this constantly, and it's an honor to do that, to have someone come, whether they know they're scared or not, something in them has allowed them to be present and learn more about this illness and hopefully stay in treatment long enough to get some help.
So interesting, because I get the sense as I'm listening to you that you really have this very clear differentiation between the person and their illness, and you're interested in having that separate, that space get wider mm-hmm. and wider and wider. And tell me more really what you mean by that. Like, what does that look like as a person? They start to see this illness as not me. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean? Like,
yes.
They're not identified with it anymore.
Yes, and that comes with behavioral change first. It doesn't come with feeling like doing something different or really getting the, you know, a lot of patients come in and say, I just want to like my body again, or I just want to feel good about eating. And I have to help them accept the fact that that's going to come a little bit later in the process. First stage is going to be, we're going to change this pattern that you have in your life so that you're no longer struggling with how many calories to have for breakfast. We're just going to establish a plan that's safe for you and change this behavior. And eventually, if you do it consistently enough, you're definitely going to feel better and have some motivation to look at some other ways to really take charge of an illness that's, you know, most patients gravitate toward these illnesses because they want to have a sense of control, perhaps. And it's really a flip. When the illness is in charge of the person, you know, it's hard to see that initially.
How out of control they've become.
Yeah.
All the while longing for more control.
Yes, control and companionship and things that they can share with other people rather than be different.
Yeah. You know, when you say the difficulty of allowing someone to keep doing something, you know, it's sort of not wanting to take control of them, essentially, mm-hmm. or sort of the difficulty of... Where I relate to you is around, you know, if I have someone who's very suicidal and, you know, not wanting to just like throw them into the hospital, mm-hmm. but really trusting them and knowing that trusting them is actually part of their recovery.
It is.
But it's very difficult for the clinician.
It is very difficult. And I've found the one thing that has made the biggest impact is including family members in treatment.
How do you mean?
Well, a patient that's a teenager who has parents who care about them has such a greater chance for full recovery than someone who tries to tackle this alone. So with adolescents, I really first empower the parents to be parents.
And how? What does that mean?
By letting them know that the patient who's malnourished or who's doing things to themselves that are dangerous is... maybe very mature on some levels, but very immature on some others. And a parent wouldn't let a kid drive the car when they're 3 years old or even go out of the driveway without the car seat in. So that's the level of parenting that they have to go to with an eating disorder. They're going to prepare the meals. They're going to be with their child 100% of the time. They're going to supervise them until they demonstrate readiness to have more independence. And it's the person with the illness that demonstrates that readiness by complying with a plan and succeeding in a very narrow framework and then moving forward.
I can imagine for some families, it's a very challenging thing to do that because, you know, some of the literature on eating disorders suggests, you know, it has a very mother blaming focus,
yep.
like the mother is too intrusive or too controlling mm-hmm. and this is her daughter's attempt to assert her independence. So then if actually what the mother needs to do to help the daughter is to become more authoritative.
Mm-hmm. Temporarily.
Yeah, I can see that that's challenging.
It's challenging and freeing once folks realize that they just have to trust that pattern of what they know to do as parents and not let go to, you know, if you let an eating disorder become the parent, that child is not asserting their independence either. So it's really just returning the level of balance in the family.
Are there things that you teach parents or families that are really unhelpful to someone struggling with an eating disorder?
To ask that question, I didn't understand.
Well, I think that parents are often afraid of saying the wrong thing
uh-huh.
or doing the wrong thing. And are there things that you help people learn, like, yeah, that is unhelpful. Don't
uh-huh.
do that.
Sure,
and what would
sure.
be some of those things?
Oh, you know, people put their feet in their mouth all the time. We all of us humans do. I guess we teach by example by having a lot of humor in the treatment plan so that, you know, everybody needs to be able to laugh at themselves a little bit and acknowledge that it's not going to go perfectly, but let's try again or let's give a level of forgiveness here and take things less personally in terms of communication. We're really just trying to get along and get this enemy out of our lives. Mm-hmm. So everything else can be, you know, not so militaristic. And folks really tend to come out of this thinking, oh, wow, we never sat down for dinner before as a family. Wow, this is a good thing to not have things organized around the illness.
Are there specific risk factors that you notice in families that you think make a person more or less likely to develop an eating disorder?
Yes and no. I guess I would hesitate to pin them down too tightly because I think anybody could be susceptible given circumstances or stressors in their family. You know, you may be born with a temperament that is highly organized, and then you may gravitate towards sports or talents that are highly disciplined or have a body image component. And then you might have your dog die or your parents might split up. And so any of these factors can lead a person to get, you know, or you may have a body habit is that you're always worried about your weight and your family's always been worried about your weight. There are just so many factors that can lead into these things because, you know, while it may have an addictive quality to it, it's not like alcohol or another substance. You need food. So you can't just stay away from it. You need to have a developed, healthy relationship with it.
Right. I mean, so the goal becomes moderation, not teetotaling, mm-hmm. which is a whole different thing to work.
Yes, it is.
So I'm curious, you know, about the role of culture, too. We've talked a little bit about family.
Yeah.
But, you know, we live in an appearance-obsessed culture for women especially, but also increasingly for men. And what do you tell people about that? Or, I mean, do you ever prescribe a total, you know, abstinence from consuming any media images? Or what's your sense of the power of the media in fostering eating disorders?
Well, I think there's an economy of dissatisfaction in this culture. People make money on humans being unhappy with the way they look or with what they have so that they'll either buy more or choose things that, you know, keep the economy of dissatisfaction running. Once folks start looking at that, they have more power over their choices. And we have a lot of patients who really do choose not to subscribe to certain magazines or not to, you know, to at least watch ads with a different focus for themselves. Wow, somebody's really exploiting me with that. And I think that kind of education, maybe rather than abstinence, is useful because it's going to be everywhere. I think some of the part that worries me the most is children are exposed so much earlier than they used to be. So we are seeing and assessing children as young as 5 with true eating disorders.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's culture. And that's a brain that's not fully developed to analyze or discern differences yet. So it's much more worrisome.
And the treatment, I imagine, would be so different for a 5-year-old than a 15-year-old.
Yes. Well, yes and no. It may be a little bit simpler. Some kids just come in straight from a health class. You know, a certain temperament in a child will say, oh, I'm afraid to lose weight and go out and start swinging on the swing set for hours. So, you know, it's poignant to see how this can play into our culture. And again, it's just so much more important for the parents to stay with their instincts and pay attention to what's happening.
It sounds like teaching media literacy in a way, mm-hmm. sort of the ability to really question what you're being fed.
Yes.
Visually.
Yeah.
Is part of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm also curious, you know, for you, part of, I think, what's so powerful about eating disorders is that our bodies are public. You know, people can see us. They mm-hmm. see what we look like in a way that makes it harder to hide mm-hmm. than other struggles. And I was curious, how is it for you to work there as the team doc? Is there a way that you can become more self-conscious about your own body when you're there and you're talking to people all day long who are obsessed with bodies and food? I mean, do you find that there's a contagiousness about it that you have to kind of really consciously not get sucked into?
Not really. I think I'm aware of my role and I have a responsibility to pay attention to my own health habits, whether that's, you know, regularly exercising, eating well. The patients see our team eat together at noontime every day, and we rotate between eating with the patients and then the rest of the staff, you know, having treatment team meetings and things. But I think we, not just me, but my whole team are responsible for being confident in what we say and what we do. We all enjoy dressing in our own personal styles. So I think it's really just part of mentoring and modeling the way you would for your own kids.
It's almost even more important for you to be healthy in that context.
Yep. But that's true, you know, as a physician anyway, I think there's a responsibility that goes with that if you're going to practice what you preach.
True, although it isn't always so visibly clear to others.
No, but I think, you know, in medicine we're taught to not admit mistakes either. So I really think that's part of you know, I really want patients to know that I'm just doing the best I can too. I'm not full of answers and devoid of questions. So we work out solutions together a lot of times, and I think that's part of the modeling process too.
It makes sense, because I think about the links between perfectionism and anorexia, mm-hmm. and it feels like health is so much about embracing our flawedness and not striving for some ideal.
And the bulimic tendencies really are very artistic in a lot of ways, and breaking the rules and seeing what else you can do and sometimes how far you can push a limit. So all those are usable and important skills if you can channel them in ways that
it's
aren't
fascinating to think of those as artistic tendencies.
Yeah,
I like that reframe. Yeah. You said to me earlier when we were preparing for this conversation that you feel like in some ways your own maternal instincts have served you better than anything in how you approach this treatment. And I wondered if you could say more about that.
It just feels right. I've raised my own children. I've raised students of various disciplines, and I feel like I raised my patients in a lot of ways.
And when I think about maternal instincts, I mean, I think in some ways about fierce protection.
Yep.
I think about worry. I think about nurturing. Yes. Is that what you mean?
Yes, all of that together. I'm where the buck stops. You know, patients may come in and they think I'm just the biggest hard nose on the planet, and I am about safety. I will not give up on a patient. And that's daunting. I know that at first. But it's my role to hold that boundary for safety and then to allow patients to move forward and take their own lead. And it's a developmental process, I think, that is true of mothering. You know, we carry children, we raise them, we protect them, and then we let them go. So that cycle happens constantly, and it's a wonderful thing.
Your patients stay with you about 3 weeks every day.
Usually.
So it's an accelerated process.
It is.
It would seem.
It is.
You said something earlier in the show that got my attention too. You talked about the importance of people listening to themselves as part of their recovery. And tell me what you mean by that.
Well, that's just an ongoing process. I think you, as you can deceive other people, you can deceive yourself as well. Defense mechanisms come into play in that way. And I think we all have a sense sometime of what our own voice is. And it takes practice to hear yourself and decide, wait, do I really mean that? Or am I just saying that for somebody else? Or how do I know the difference? What is it that really isn't most important to me? And that's an ongoing process that sometimes the eating disorder sidetracks for a while.
I mean, it seems to me, I think initially I was thinking you were meaning it in terms of, am I really hungry?
Well, and hungry can be used in so many different ways. Body physical cues really can't be trusted with eating disorders.
What do you mean?
Well, the brain will tell you that you're hungry or not when your body may really be in need of nourishment. So we really have patients ignore those body cues for a while until they get established in a pattern of safety. And then they come back and they're more reliable. But sometimes the brain and the body trick each other into things that just aren't true.
I see. So you try to get someone sort of in a regular, moderate pattern of eating, safe.
Yep.
And then after that's established, then you start listening inside to what your body's needing. Because in the beginning, it's so
been
out of kilter.
It's so distorted. It really can't be trusted in the initial stages.
I know that some people have written about eating disorders and food as a way of sort of stuffing down strong emotion, strong feeling. It's a way of kind of numbing. It almost kind of puts people out to sleep, like a form of anesthetic. And do you find that as people start getting better, they do access more emotion?
Oh, absolutely. And some of that's delightful and some of it's terrifying to the individual. sometimes we ask patients to have planned freakouts. they can't fathom what that would entail. But and sometimes it's very mild, and sometimes it's...
And you plan it so that they feel safer and a little bit more control.
Okay, let's say 2 o'clock tomorrow, you're just going to have a freak out about the fact that your father always makes you do X, Y, or Z. And it gets kind of fun when you know it's not a dangerous thing to express emotions, but that's just one side of it.
Patrice, we're going to have to stop, but I want to ask you, it's such a pleasure to talk to you about this. I feel like your patients are very lucky to have you. What are some resources that you would recommend for people to read or websites to check out if you want to learn more about eating disorders?
There are a couple of good websites. There are a lot of bad ones.
Let's go with the good ones for now.
To see. So I would pick, the two that I would steer people towards. One is called somethingfishy.com, which has all sorts of positive things to do with eating disorder recovery. Another one for parents is Maudsley Parents.
And that's M-A-U-D-S-L-E-Y.
L-E-Y.
Yeah. Maudsleyparents.org. Uh-huh.
Which has everything from great recipes to other parents' experiences with eating disorders. A good book would be How to Help Your Teenager Beat an Eating Disorder. I think it starts with the help part.
Help Your Teenager Beat an Eating Disorder. Uh-huh. Great.
Very good for lay people.
Patrice Lockhart, I'm going to have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for being my guest. If someone wants more information about the New England Eating Disorder Program at Mercy Hospital, what's the phone number there?
879-3795. And please call with any questions.
Thank you very much. This is Dr. Ann, and I've been talking to Dr. Patrice Lockhart about the psychiatric treatment of eating disorders.